The Loose Cannons podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
Now what you need now is a good rest. Now, a few things to be worked out in the morning, but my boys will clear those up and you needn't worry none.
Your boys?
Mm-hmm.
You're the head of it all?
There never was a struggle in the soul of a good man that wasn't hard. My papa told me that. And it's sure enough true.
Hey, everyone. It's another episode of Loose Cannons coming at you. Mm-hmm. Today we're going to be discussing 1966's Seconds, directed by John Frankenheimer. Before we do that, let's do this little segment we like to call Heralds and Announcements. Burr, burr, burr. Bam. Mm. Patrick?
Well, I would like to denounce the movie Sleepless. I saw that last night. I had high hopes for it, and it ended up being a very incompetent mess of a movie.
Would you say you had a sleepless night with it?
Not at all, actually. I was pretty, I was actually kind of amused by how incompetent it was at times. It was actually kind of funny to watch, certain things that happened in it.
Possible Upside Down award winner of 2017.
That's what I was thinking at certain times while watching it. I was like, this could be an Upside Down movie because, some of it is so ridiculous. A lot of Michelle Monaghan's dialogue in it is ridiculous. And T.I., as Jamie Foxx's partner, makes some pretty ridiculous faces in the movie. Nice. But I don't think it quite crossed the line into ridiculous enough. It took itself a little too seriously, I guess. Or it got a little too, I don't know. It potentially could be. At times I was is this a parody? But then I was just no, it just seems like the person making it was pretty incompetent and not trying to make a parody of this. So, yeah, I was disappointed but slightly amused by my disappointment, so yeah.
Probably not going to make your worst of the year list.
Probably not, but I can slightly recommend if you want to have a good laugh at Jamie Foxx's expense, I guess.
I always do. That's not true. I like Jamie Foxx just fine.
Yeah. I like him too. It seemed like he, throughout the movie, is in pain because he's been stabbed, and I was like, he's really just wishing that he was in a different movie. That's the pain on his face. He's using it.
Having to say these lines, causing this grimace.
Yeah, he's probably given two of my favorite performances of the last 15 years in Django and Collateral.
Yeah.
Even though I don't tend to think of him as one of my favorite actors, but I guess those are two really good performances.
Yeah, he's a pretty talented dude.
Basil!
I'm going to go ahead and denounce Death Race 2050, which is the brand new third remake of the Death Race 2000 film. This one, Roger Corman came back to produce, so he's repicking up his lineage, but it's a really bad movie. I don't know. I think that some of the charm of those 60s and 70s Corman movies is their low budgetness, but for me in the year 2017, it's very hard for me to find low-budget movies charming, because instead of just making cheaply made, schlocky movies with, in real places, now everyone just substitutes with really bad CGI, so there's, a bunch of shots of like people who are supposed to be in this like crowded arena, but it's very clear that it's just like a weatherman type thing where they're just like standing in front of a screen that's like a crowded arena behind them that's slightly out of focus. And I didn't find it very fun. I guess the funniest part to me is that I guess they couldn't afford anything like real stunt drivers or anything like that. So whenever it shows shots of the cars driving, it's very clear they were driving about 20 miles an hour and they just sped up the footage a lot. So it looks really terrible.
Nice.
Oh boy. Wow.
So yeah.
Both of these sound like fun.
Yep.
I actually had to do an effect like that for a movie that I shot in college, where it was like people were about to get run over by a car, and I had to speed it up so it looked like they were really about to get run over.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that there are ways where you can slightly speed up footage and get away with it, but anytime you move the camera, you're showing your hand, because the camera's just moving in this goofy, slightly too fast way that no one would ever pan a camera, so... Good job, filmmakers.
I interviewed Roger Corman once back when I briefly worked at the Munich Film Festival, and cool. He was a very nice, very polite person who, when he talked, never blinked. So that was a very interesting experience. He was like basically like the kind of person that just, you know, David Lynch would make a whole movie around, just like following the guy around, being a mix of 50s politeness and just Hannibal Lecter creepiness. I watched a couple of good things over the last couple of weeks, and like the last thing I watched was OJ's Made in America. Not OJ's Made in America. As if it's endorsed by him.
He directed it. Didn't you know that?
He's produced it, like the way Quentin Tarantino produced Chungking Express. That was pretty cool. Very intense sort of thing. I actually pretty much watched all of them back to back, so that made for a pretty involved experience. I don't know, since I haven't heard the Heralds yet, I don't know how, if it showed up on anyone's list or if it did, how high it was, but that would, since I watched it now and it never came out in Germany, it might as well make my 2017 list at some point.
Nice.
That was
good on you.
I especially liked the fact that there was very they introduced, obviously it was talking heads and everything, but like they introduced people who start talking, and since I didn't know a lot about the case, I didn't know who a lot of those people were, so the racist cop, when he starts talking in the beginning, I was like, something off about this guy. But I mean, you know, it's not immediately obvious that he's
Furman. It's a racist. Racist name.
So yeah, no, that was it was interesting how your relationship to those talking heads changes a lot over the period of watching it.
Yeah, I had the same experience because I was a child when the thing happened, and a child who was not particularly interested in news, so I saw the car chase when it was on, but I didn't follow any of the case after that, so Mark Furman was an unknown figure to me as well.
Right.
I only knew about him because of that Chappelle Show sketch.
I remember him. Although Basil and I are the oldest, and I don't know, I probably had the most news-centric parents.
Yeah.
Yeah, my mom never watched the news. I only saw the news when I was at my grandparents' house. Like, I just happened to be at my grandparents' house when the chase happened. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't have even seen that.
Well, if there's anything that we learned from our lists, it's that we don't care what year a movie came out.
It's true.
For you to put it on a list, so you will have no problem with that.
No, we don't.
Because I think... was it all of us that had at least one movie that came out in a different year? Or
was this on this last list?
Yeah.
I don't think I did.
Yeah,
you had Fireworks Wednesday.
Yeah, I was going to say Fireworks Wednesday.
Yeah, I think Mitchell was the only one who didn't because he's a real stickler for the rules.
Yeah.
Although when I was making my 2017 resolution list, which is to try to finish up my 2010s list by watching 100 movies from every year of the 2010s, I was including all the ones on the podcast for my 2016 list, and like almost all of them are labeled 2015 on Letterboxd.
Yeah.
That I included from y'all.
Stupid festivals, they ruin everything.
Yeah. T-Rex, City of Gold, Right Now, Wrong Then, Happy Hour, like they're all 2015. Yeah. Speaking of things that are weird and dumb, I'm gonna denounce a short film called Day and Night. This is the short film that was tagged to Toy Story 3 when it came out in theaters, but I didn't see Toy Story 3 in theaters, so I hadn't seen it. I was hoping to watch Your Next, but I ran out of time, so I could possibly have something more interesting to talk about. But Day and Night is just, you know, all of the worst qualities of Pixar put together. It's the anthropomorphized day and night, and it's like supposed to be cute, but instead it's like, you know, so all of those things that Ilya complained about Inside Out, with none of the like depth of character or anything like that. So it's super heteronormative and white and moralizing and like celebrates unfettered capitalism, as Basil put it when we were talking about it. Yeah, and it's almost universally on Letterboxd like well regarded. It's just like me and Steven are the ones who gave it a bad rating, and everything else was like 4+ stars. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't understand. Maybe it was just because it was like whatever, Toy Story came out like 6 years ago or something like that, and people hadn't realized that it was like super creepy to have like a dude just stare at a bikini woman and like go like woo woo yet, but they probably should have.
So the most popular review of this movie on Letterboxd literally says, one of the greatest movies ever made.
How do you feel about that take, Basil? You watched it as well.
Yeah, I'm on Ruben's side. It really grossed me out, yeah. Because, I mean, part of the thing that the movie is about is, like, day and night showing each other these things that they've never seen, because one's day, one's night. And so one of the great things that night discovers about day is that women walk around in bikinis and he can stare at them, and it's awesome.
Yep. And the great thing about night is that the casino is open. Yep. So you got that capitalism.
Nice.
Yeah, and I think I probably would have just, like, I mean, I still would have given it a really bad rating, but I think I knocked another whole half star off because of the part where they run into the radio station and there's a long speech about how we're only afraid of things because they're different or something like that. And I was like, maybe that played when neoliberalism was at its peak like 6 years ago or something, but now with literal Nazis invading the government, I honestly don't care about your differences. You're getting punched in the face.
Hell yeah.
Oh boy.
You should be afraid of me being different. Because I'm coming for you. I'm coming to punch you in the face.
Oh man.
The one bright moment about 2017 so far.
Yeah. Here's hoping there's many more.
That's true.
I really like the finale of The Good Place.
Oh, yeah.
I'm waiting for Basil to watch it so we can talk about it.
I would like to watch it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I hung out with Haley last night, but all we did was watch the movie we're about to talk about, so I didn't have time to watch the...
Nice.
So let's do that. Yeah. Patrick, this was your pick, right?
Yes, it was. I will give you the plot. I'm just
trying to figure out what happens in this movie? I don't even know.
All right.
This is my second time watching it, but I have no idea what happened.
All right. Well, a man named Arthur Hamilton is sort of a workaday. I think he's a banker, and he gets a mysterious address from someone at a train station, and apparently he's been getting these calls from someone he thought was dead but is actually alive, and so he goes to the address and basically discovers that it's a company who can fake his death and give him a new life and give him a new body. And so, you know, he at first doesn't want to do it, but then they show him this video that they have of him where they drugged him and sort of forced him to almost rape this woman as a blackmail. So basically they force him to go through with it at that point, and he does. And after the surgery, he looks like Rock Hudson, and his new identity is that he's a painter who lives in Malibu. And from there, he starts to kind of enjoy it for a while, but then he discovers that all the people who live around him and the woman that he's fallen in love with is, they're all sort of part of the big scheme, and he doesn't want to be part of it anymore. He starts kind of pining for his old life and his old identity. And he basically finds out by going back to his house and talking to his wife as the painter that he can't, all his stuff's been thrown out, and basically his whole life has been erased that was there. So he decides that he wants to start over again and start with a new body, but the company wants him to sponsor someone else to come into the program, because apparently that's how they continue to exist, is by having people sponsor new people to come into the program, like his friend did, his friend who he thought was dead. So he goes to do that, but then he discovers that they're not actually going to give him a new body. They're just going to kill him, because he really isn't bringing any value into their fold, I guess, by going back on his decision to have a new body, decision in air quotes. And yeah, basically the end of the movie, you see him, I'm not sure exactly what's happening to him. I guess maybe they're lobotomizing him, or, you know, doing something with his body so that they can give it to someone else. But yeah,
I think they're using him for one of the cadavers at the beginning of the movie. You know, they say that they have to,
That's
have
what I was
a cadaver to be a replacement. So
yeah,
that's what I was thinking too. They're gonna take his body and use it for something else, and just remove his brain or whatever.
Yeah.
Basil.
I feel pretty in the middle on this movie. I think it has some fun ideas and stuff like that, but some of the aesthetics I found really distracting. There's a lot of fisheye cam. There's a lot of really intense close-ups of sweaty faces and sort of strange stylistic choices that definitely feel to me like, oh, John Frankenheimer was a pretty new filmmaker, and he's got a lot of ideas, and he's I'm gonna try this, people don't really do this. And I would say probably about 50% of the time it's oh, people don't do that because it doesn't look very good. And that there's also a lot of ADR in the movie that I found very distracting. Some of the scenes are pretty fun. And there's some interesting readings of the movie that I think can be taken away. So in the end, I feel sort of middle ground about it.
Hmm. Yeah, I like this movie. I really like The Manchurian Candidate, so I guess the Frankenheimer's aesthetic at that time, and I think Manchurian Candidate was made before this movie.
Yeah.
So I think for some reason or another, his aesthetic works for me pretty well. And I feel like I didn't really know what was going on, like, for most of the movie. But I liked the sort of, I don't know, like the weird, like the only thing I kind of didn't like was the weird second act with all the stepping in the wine and whatever, which I thought was a bit too like I don't know, like weirdly maybe anti-hippie or whatever. But at the same time, I think like a lot of this movie is aimed at like how like entitled rich people don't really get to feel sorry for themselves, and so right. And so that scene for me also played in that way, like, well, a lot of these people are just like pretending to be sexually like super open and whatever, but in reality they're all kind of gross, and this is not even their bodies. Like, that's what you kind of, what I kind of was like thinking later, like, yeah, and that whole scene, none of these people were like really even real, so this is like, that makes it even grosser than I thought it was in the beginning. So yeah, I don't know, like, yeah, I liked it. I'd say like, yeah, like I gave Maturing Canon like 4 stars. I think I'd give this like pretty much about the same.
Yeah, I also liked this movie. I found,
it's Ruben's turn.
Oh, is it? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I watched this movie first time for the game, which I mentioned in the Autobiographical Canon podcast, and thought it was really, really great. And when I watched it this time, I thought that I liked it up until about 30 minutes ago, and then I was like, you know what? I don't like this movie. I agree with Basil about the visuals. I think it's pretty frustrating, too, because I think a lot of the sort of, I guess, more standard visuals are pretty affecting in a way. There's a shot of Nora on the beach in a black hoodie that I found like really unsettling for some reason. So like all of the like dumb warped fish eye stuff, and it's the same with the score. Like there's like this really blunt score that opens the movie with the credits that sort of put me on a wrong foot to begin with. But then there was like some pretty beautiful musical pieces in it as well. And eventually, like, that sort of alternate reading that Basil was hinting at, which was part of the reason why I liked the movie in the past, you know, essentially that there's this extra textual element of Rock Hudson as a gay man, and so therefore living his own sort of lie life, and, like, how you could feel, like, trapped by that. I don't know if the film supports that. In fact, I felt like a lot of it was kind of sympathy for middle-class white people not getting to live as fantastic a life as their entitlement led them to hope when they were kids. And I don't really care about that. So, yeah, I don't like this movie anymore.
I did end up liking it. I guess all the aesthetical touches that you guys talked about actually worked for me. I liked the weird sort of following shots that they have, where the guy's walking through the train station, like following him around, and they have like the camera on the low dolly where they're sliding it across the floor. I just think that it doesn't really remind me of anything else that I've seen from the 60s, like, I guess in this vein, like it doesn't seem as staid as most stuff that I've seen. And it, I don't know, those weird like angles where they have like somebody's face in focus in the foreground and there's somebody back here doing something else. I'm trying to think where I first saw that. I think it might've been like Citizen Kane or something, but I've always really liked that look, that sort of kind of deep focus look where you have somebody in focus here and then somebody's in focus like doing something behind them. I have always kind of liked that look, and so it, you know, it worked for me here, especially in the scene where he's talking with the old man, where he's, I guess, basically making his, or the old man is sort of like convincing him to go through with the procedure, and it's just that one long shot where he's framed right in the middle, and the old man kind of moves from one side to the other and is like sitting there by him. you know, like the almost like the like angel devil thing like on his shoulders. I was like, this is interesting, and I also liked that old man is like, he was so like sweet looking and he talked so pretty that he was very creepy to me. I was like, oh man, this is exactly the like the way I guess you could see the devil just like convincing somebody to do something, like, you know, I can't remember what the line is he said, but I think it would be a good one for our opening maybe, where he says, I'm trying to remember what it was, I think it was the no moral decision is easy in the soul of a good man or something like that. And I was like, that's a good line. If you're trying to convince somebody of something creepily, it's not really a true line, but it's a good line to like sell somebody on something.
It's true.
Yeah,
you're appealing to their own morality and be like, oh, of course this isn't an easy decision for you because you're a good person, but
but yeah, I do
still the right thing for you to do.
Yeah, I do agree that it does seem a little too, I guess, of its time and its morality of like, oh, it's so sad that people don't get to live out their real dreams or whatever. You know, I just think it's not radical enough in that area. I think it's pushing towards something, but it hasn't gotten far enough yet. Like it's just too of its time in that.
Yeah, maybe that might. So, yeah. My reading of it might have been just owed to like kind of hoping that this maybe had a more subversive element to it, because I didn't feel bad for anybody in this movie like at all. I thought that it was like pure like the just it was like a lot of it was like a really nasty joke, like played like very straight, and like I mean I don't know why anyone would feel sorry for the main guy who's like a rich banker, and like, oh, so he doesn't talk to his wife, oh, that's sad, so that's why he wants to change his entire life and become somebody completely different and basically fake his own death. I thought that was like a really strange like,
I mean, the person that I felt bad for, I guess, was his wife, because like, yeah, she is actually like trying to be invested in, you know, she's trying to love him and he's just like disconnected and not there, and I was like, oh, this is sad for her, like, you know, you know, she wants this to be good and he's just not even seeing it. Like, I guess it's in a way it's supposed to be kind of a tragedy like that, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think that the grape stomping is super gross looking, and I feel like that part of the reason that at least worked a little bit for me was, like, I feel like in the 60s, I mean, having watched, like, Mad Men and all these other things, like, there's a bunch of really rich people who were like, oh, I wish I wasn't burdened by this job and this family that I was stuck with because the 50s told me I had to, and I wish I could, like, go to California and just be a playboy, and then like he gets all of that and then he's like, oh, this is disgusting, I don't want this after all.
I do like that grape stomping scene though.
Yeah,
it's like I just like them going, stop those grapes.
So Ilya, can you provide me some textual evidence for disliking the character? I mean, I dislike him too, but I don't know if I think the film does.
You mean the main character? Yeah, it's like, I guess what I kind of like, what you might think of as disliking is just as how he just doesn't even fight any of the things that are happening to him, like at all. Like, he gets basically suckered into this whole situation and he doesn't even try to get out of it. Like, there's very little where he's even like standing up for himself in any way. Like, he's just kind of like this very, I don't know, like a strange person who doesn't like control his life in any way, which to me seems a bit like, I guess you could feel sorry for that, but it's also like, all right, well, it's hard to think of that as like the movie's like hero or whatever. Like,
yeah, I mean, if I was gonna say like there is a textual argument in this movie for him as a bad person, I would say it rests with his wife, because that scene where she is like trying to kiss him and like trying to make love to him, he's just like ignoring her. I was like, this is the scene where I'm like, this guy is kind of a heel. Like, his, you know, he has a wife who clearly loves him and clearly wants to be with him, and he is, you know, it doesn't go far enough in my opinion, but I think if there is any evidence, it rests at in that point. Like,
yeah, I was gonna say the other scene for me is him at his job, because he's not just a banker, he's like a loan officer.
Yeah.
And the only time we see him at work is him like writing a weird form letter denying someone the loan that they're requesting, and he's like, yeah, et cetera, et cetera, like standard closing. Like, he's so indifferent to the fact that like whoever he is on the other end of that letter really obviously wanted that money, but to him it's just like, here's my job where I tell people they can't have things that they maybe need, and I'm completely emotionally uninvested in it.
Yeah, so first of all, I think like what responding to what Ilya said, I mean, doesn't that sort of play into what Basil was already saying about this sort of idea of feeling like they had to do something? And like, this is just sort of a creepy sci-fi Twilight Zone extension of like, they don't actually have any control over his life. Like, even him, his getting to live out his dream is like something that they force out of him using drugs or whatever, what his dream is. And like, that getting pulled along is again, you know, sort of really victimizing him. And I probably would say that I agree with Patrick's reading of the lovemaking scene, although I don't know, I feel like sometimes the way that the film shoots the wife like intentionally makes her look like old in a way that kind of made me uncomfortable, and like therefore being like, yeah, it kind of makes sense. Wouldn't you want to leave this old lady some hot young tail or whatever? But I disagree with the reading of the banking scene, because to me it seems like less like he doesn't care about the person on the other end, but that he's doesn't care about this job in particular because he's not emotionally connected to it. That like, yeah, I guess what he is doing in that moment is cruel, but that, you know, that's part of what's killing him, I guess, is that he doesn't do a thing that means anything to him, and that, you know, that's part of his like frustration with his secondary life, is that he's still not doing a thing that means anything to him. That like, we'll provide you with paintings until, you know, you've created some sort of inner life. And like, a lot of this movie is like about his lack of like an inner life in a sense.
I think the movie does like push it too far in the direction of him being a victim, but by having him be sort of railroaded into the procedure, because I think if they don't include that whole sequence where he's sort of like drugged and they force his body on that woman, I think then you could make more of an argument for him like being more of a bad person, like the movie actually being on the side of him being kind of a heel. But because that's I do feel like the movie's trying to make him more of a victim.
He doesn't know what's going to happen at the end, but like, don't you think that like, you're supposed to kind of think it's noble that he won't give them another name? That like, he, you know, had trouble going into this process, and obviously he was like frustrated with it, and therefore he's not willing to just like offer up somebody else, even though they keep bugging him about it.
A commentary on the fact that like his life is so devoid of connection.
He doesn't even know anybody.
Because like the only person he's connected to in the movie is his dead friend or whatever, but like that guy's already in the program.
Well, I guess he doesn't invite his wife to join the program, so yeah, I guess that speaks to him.
Yeah, that's what I was going
to
say, like potentially his wife could have been part of it, but yeah,
if he didn't care about anybody, I guess, in that sense, like, if he wasn't thinking about that at all, he could have just thrown out a random name. Like, he could have just been, like, someone he worked... Like, I don't believe that he doesn't know any names.
Yeah.
He's making a stand there. He works with people at a bank. He he's met people at a club before. He could just say a lonely casual acquaintance if and, you know, try to push forward in the program. He's making some sort of stand by saying he doesn't know anyone who would be a good candidate. I don't believe that it's just because he's a lonely person.
So then his time as Rock Hudson basically transforms him into a better person.
And... No, I think that, I mean, because I still sort of disagree with that. I feel like, you know, I mean, he's also acting sort of selfishly because he wants to move on right away. He keeps arguing like, hey, if I give you this name, then I'm going to be tied to this person and I'll have to keep talking to them. And then I'll slow down me, like, getting my new life because what I want is, like, my
That's
new,
true.
Not Rock Hudson life. Like,
it's true. But I didn't think about that.
I don't know. I mean... Yeah, what was I gonna say? I think that I mean he couldn't have offered his wife though because this is just for men.
Yeah, it's for men. Like, it's a man program.
Oh, right. Nice.
Yeah.
I didn't even pick up on that.
Yeah.
It's like right,
I mean that's probably men. My second one, definitely one of my favorite shots in the movie is all the angry men. He's not playing, he doesn't want to play the game anymore and he's getting really drunk and they're all just angrily staring at him. Yeah, they're like, you're ruining it for everybody.
That's true. I forget about
that. I also like the shot of all the bored men, like, who are waiting to have their lives changed but are actually just waiting to be turned into cadavers, and they're just sitting there like playing cards and stuff like that in this weird room with no windows. But, I mean, I think that, like, there's a funny-ish, like, sort of cruel, like, parallel in this movie where when he first goes to find the place, it's, like, in a dry cleaner's and they're just, like, steaming all these clothes and they're like, oh, no, we moved the place. It's not here anymore. Yeah. And then he goes to, like, a huge meat packing plant and it's just, like, these are, like, equivalent things. And then, like, at the end of the movie... with all those guys sitting in that room, they're just like a different kind of capitalist meat packing plant. They're just waiting to be turned into cadavers. And I thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. There's some pretty dark capitalism going on here.
Yeah. But I mean, it's also pretty telling. Like, it's not just men. It's also only rich men that get to participate in this.
Yeah.
Like, that's made pretty clear that this whole thing, well, yeah, but like, I wouldn't give the movie enough credit to comment on that, but I would give it enough credit just because it spells out the financial element pretty clearly.
It would be pretty difficult anyway, even if they included people of color, to find a rich person of color in 1966.
Right. Yeah.
You're going to have to probably go to a different country.
You might have to...
Or Muhammad Ali. Or those are your choices.
Yeah, I was thinking of Berry Gordy, actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think... what was really funny to me about
Hey, Sidney Poitier, would you like to give up your life to be a white playboy? No.
Would you like to paint things at a beach forlornly? Like, that whole transformation to me was really kind of funny because, like, so Rock Hudson really wants to be a painter, but of course, where does he get to be a painter? He gets to be a painter with, like, a beach house on Malibu. Well, for what? Like, for paintings? Like, that's ridiculous to me. Like, that whole idea was like, what? What painter gets to live on that in a house like that? What the fuck?
Sure, there are some, you know.
I guess
I'm sure, you know.
Oh yeah, there definitely are. But I thought that, I mean, I don't know if that's an intentional commentary or not, but I do think it is funny the idea that Los Angeles people, rich people, are so oblivious to culture that you could just show up and be like, hey, I'm a famous painter in other countries, and they'd be like, oh, we haven't heard of you. Welcome to our club.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm in on the ground floor of this, you know, art movement or whatever. Let me buy all your paintings.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of how the art world works, actually. It's just all about patronage.
Right.
I do like Nora, though. Something that I do like about this film. I like her acting and I like her characterization. I like the way that she's like, especially when you find out that she's part of the company, that, like, you know, she's providing this phony 60s experience of, like,
right,
free love or whatever. Like, yeah, you know, it's so stupid when she runs into the ocean to, like, ask a question, but then when you realize that it's all part of an act, like, it kind of makes me feel similarly to, like, Out of the Blue does, and that it's like, yeah, we had all these, like, great free love ideas, and it's like, but they all come with, like, this kind of gross hangover afterwards, right, when you, yeah, you do all those drugs. So I thought she was pretty cool. Yeah.
I don't know if it was just me sort of, like, I guess I kind of already knew where the movie was going, but I knew, like, almost right away when I saw her, I was like, I bet she's a plant. Like,
yeah,
I bet she's, well, they shoot it in a way to make her uncomfortable looking.
Yeah, but I think the movie kind of telegraphed that already a little bit. Like, when, like, it's clear that he's not meeting anybody, and then he meets her. Well, it's, you know, and then, like, all these other people seem a bit robot-y, you know. Then,
yeah. Well, so, yeah, and the fact that John keeps insisting that he go meet other people who live around him, I was like, I bet they're all people that are in on it, like.
Yeah. yeah. What was I say?
I was going to say, I mean, this is totally unrelated to almost everything, but I also watched Laura very recently, so this is two movies in a very short period of time that are very clear that David Lynch really loves.
Yeah.
Like, the way the finale of this movie is shot, when they're, like, pulling him around and there's all those weird shots of him, like, trying to get out, and he's, like, shaking his face, is, like, exactly how, what's his name, Balthazar Getty looks at the very end of Lost Highway when he's, like, driving. He starts, like, shaking his face, and I was like, oh, these shots are, like, exactly the same. Mm. David Lynch really loves seconds, apparently.
I bet.
Yeah.
When you were talking about the meatpacking plant, I was thinking about Killer of Sheep.
It's a movie I still have not seen.
Always what I think about. Killer of Sheep or, like, Tookie Bookie, something like that.
But I mean, and also, I guess, like, Lost Highway seems very inspired by this in terms of, like, a guy being a guy who hates his marriage and then changes into a different person for the second half of the movie.
Yeah. I like Rock Hudson's acting in this movie, but I think he's a pretty funny, bad, drunk actor. Like, I thought that whole scene was so weird because, like, he's clearly, like, gets drunk, like, really early, and then
at the party,
and then, like, it's just, like, very bad drunk acting, like, the way, like, everything happens to him.
Who's the winner between him and Ryan Gosling in The Nice Guys?
Right. yeah
exactly.
The part that I thought was funny about this and that scene, and also not intentionally, is when someone makes the comment about having a hollow leg, which is what you say to someone who's been drinking a lot who isn't acting drunk, but he's acting super drunk. And I was like, he obviously does, like, his whole body is, like, filled with sawdust, obviously. He's not doing, he's not putting this alcohol anywhere except for right on the surface. Might as well be bathing in it.
I was just gonna say, he must have not had a lot of experience drinking, being a, you know, boring banker for so many years.
It's true, yeah. I mean, Nora tells him very early on, hey, maybe don't do that, and then, like, the very next scene, he's just downing another martini again.
Yeah.
An intentional joke that I like, that again pulls off of what Basil was saying about the, you know, meat market, I guess, is so when he arrives, he's wearing, like, the uniform for people who work there, and I noticed that the little tag, what it says on the uniform, is used cow dealer.
Yeah, I saw that too. And it also says honest, which is, like, a weird thing to, like, for a meat packing plant to be advertising, because I feel like that's, like, when McDonald's started advertising 100% beef, is, like, was it not before?
Yeah.
like Taco Bell beef. It's like 33% beef.
But yeah, like I would never think to that my butcher was selling me dishonest meat until I saw that they said that they were honest. And I was like, is this a new thing for you?
To that, to take that on a tangent really quickly, I was actually like a little bit more heartened when I found out that Taco Bell's beef wasn't 100% beef. I was like, oh, it's mostly like, I can't remember what it was. It was like some sort of like imitation, like, oh my gosh, I can't remember what it was now. But it was some sort of like plant-based thing. And I was like, oh, so that's actually like, that's pretty good. Actually, that's better for the environment that they're not using all real beef in their tacos.
Yeah, but then soy though, which is soy,
yeah.
The environment.
Yeah, but then they're not honest, obviously.
Yeah.
True, but
you can't be just like, oh, you can't be like just that, a little bit of a crazy world polluter and producer of like massive amounts of fast food. You have to be all out. Like I'm like, fuck you, McDonald's. Stop selling salad. Just only sell fucking burger patties from now on.
Don't put it on bread. Just have a sluice that comes down to the table so people just put their mouth.
Exactly. Just like a patty shoot.
Just like this. Yeah,
just shooting it into people's mouths.
I was gonna say like this, a beef shake just like dribbles.
Beef shake.
Yeah, and then like put honest all over your place because then I could totally get beyond that.
Honest McDonald's. Hey, are y'all excited about seeing the founder?
Yeah. Just like yeah.
The Ketanissance is on.
84% on Rotten Tomatoes, so probably really good.
Yeah, studios made a big mistake by pushing an obvious award film to not award season.
I was talking about it with my boss yesterday, and it was pretty funny. He was like, oh yeah, when I saw it was the same director who made Saving Mr. Banks, I was like, this makes 100% sense. Apparently, this guy's shtick to just make movies about assholes that people don't like, but pretend that they're really great people. And he's like, what's next? The Comcast story?
Yeah. Time Warner Cable.
America's real heroes.
Oh, my God.
Make it like a Marvel universe where they then all star in each other's movies.
They have to beat back union organizers.
Unions are fighting us. Unions are fighting us. Get my friend in here. Then the McDonald's guys walk in.
Someone call Ted.
Yeah. One of them like turns into the Hulk and like punches a union in the face. Like,
Ted, do you think we can drive a real
union work?
Big media campaign to make people think that unions are bad? Yeah. Fake John Williams score plays.
An invasion of New York, but instead of aliens, it's poor people asking for money. And they're just beating them up. They're like, you can't have any of our money.
Yeah, and the movie ends.
They're all protecting Trump Tower.
Yeah, the movie ends with
it's the last stand.
With them just like scar-facing it in Trump Tower, exactly. Yeah.
Ronald Reagan shows up with an eye patch.
I call it trickle-down economics.
Oh, boy.
Nice.
I was going to say, I mean, to get back onto the movie... there is a part like when they're talking him into it that I do think makes him seem like kind of a bad person. When they're like, he's like the I think it's the like Colonel Sandersy, like old salesman guy.
Yeah. I like that guy.
Yeah, me too.
But as far as devil stand-ins, Faustian dudes, he's pretty fun.
Yeah.
But he says like, you are accepted. You're absolved of all responsibility in the world except your own interest. I was like, doesn't sound good.
Yeah. And according to his IMDb page, he was the grandfather on the Waltons, too. So
nice.
That's a double, like, He was in the most folksy, like, mainstream show that you can possibly imagine.
And then he was in Seconds.
And then he's in Seconds. Or actually, I guess he was in Seconds before the Waltons, but yeah.
So, does the movie then maybe read as in any way, like, a critique of that whole desire to want to, like, just be able to just change your life at any second, and that something was wrong with thinking that just is owed to you at any given moment? Like,
I don't know. I mean, like, go ahead, Ruben.
I mean, I think, I don't know. I think that maybe it's confused. I don't.
Yeah.
It's like, I feel like, yeah, there are parts that hint at that, but then, like, because of, you know, how he, like, I don't know, the fact that, I don't even know, like, the way that he reacts to it and how, like, upset he is about it and how we're, like, okay with him being upset about it. I don't know. It just feels like it doesn't hit the right note.
Upset with what? Sorry, it's just so I know what you mean.
Just his second life. Oh. How upset he is with his second life.
Yeah. Yeah. But again, that to me, that just read, like, obviously as just him being kind of a, like, that just is, the whole thing would seem just shitty to me. That none of that life read to me as, like, you know, anything that, you know, like, it was hard to me to even think of him as, like, oh, worthy of sympathy, because he's just so whiny about everything. So, like, and it's just like, oh, yeah. And it's also fake. Well, you knew it was fake. Your whole body is fake. Why do you get all up in arms when you realize everybody around you is also fake? Wouldn't that be kind of like the logical conclusion? But I don't know.
Yeah. Like, I can definitely imagine, like, a way in which this movie is pitched where, like, the part where he's saying, I went to Harvard, but I didn't go to Harvard, is, like, a pretty funny joke about, like, I don't know, like, he has, like, he's just going back and forth between variations of, like, a perfect life, like, lives that someone would look up to no matter which version of this life that he has.
Right.
And he's just unhappy with all of them, but it's just, I don't feel like if that's the movie's point that it lands for
me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I agree that it doesn't fully work, but I do think that I, at least as I was watching the movie, my feeling on it was that it was like, that was sort of the thing, is that you, if you have, like, a facile, empty life that you hate, you can't just, like, do other stuff. And then that, like, it's not, like, some other life that's going to make you happy, because, like, it's always going to be a facile, empty thing if that's who you are or whatever. But, because, like, he's like, oh, I thought it would be different, but there's just, like, these things. Like, I had these things, and now I have these other things, and they're just things. They're all the same.
Yeah, and it's also, like, why, like, I guess one reason could be, like, he does not own the consequences of the life he lived. Like, he lived his life to be this way, and that's how it turned out. And then he's like, and then at this point, he's going to be like, oh, shit, yeah, do-over right now. Like, really, really need it. And I really deserve it, too. You know, that fucking sucks. Like, that's a shitty
way. What do you make of the part when he goes to see his wife or ex-wife?
Yeah.
His widow.
Yeah.
And then, like, so he goes to see her. And then, like, the scene after, like, he's, like, saying to his assistant butler dude, you know, who's, like, seems upset with him. And he's like, I had to find out where I went wrong, or, like, what was bad. Like, doesn't that, I don't know.
Yeah, it's gross.
I feel like this movie was, it's still, like, caught in its time a little bit, and it was advancing something that seemed kind of radical at the time, but now, I guess looking at, you know, way more radical ideas that have been pushed forward, it looks really tame by comparison. And so that is what I think the problem is. I think that at the time, like, Frankenheimer was pushing a button that seemed pretty radical, but, like, looking at it through a modern lens, it's like, it could be, like, there are opportunities for it to be way more radical, but it just, I don't know if he could have gotten that movie made at the time that he made it.
Oh, yeah. I was gonna say, Ruben, I mean, this was a long time ago, but when you're talking about the wife, I actually didn't notice that, but I was distracted because, I mean, I feel like they make him look really gross and old too.
They sure do.
Yeah, like if, you know, if they're doing that to the wife, it's not just like a one-sided thing, because...
No, I agree.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I guess...
I mean, they did that with a lot of the fisheye lenses with a lot of different people. Mm. Yeah. But again, like, I don't know, like, it seemed to me, again, whenever he went, like, pretty intense with visual stuff, that it didn't really work for me. And sometimes there were a lot subtler things that I thought worked really well, like when the guy was eating his chicken.
Yeah, yeah.
That was, like, my favorite scene in the whole movie. He's like, the chicken they make here.
It's so good.
It's so good. Yeah. It's so it's delicious. He's like, are you sure you're not going to have any?
Yeah.
I mean, he's like, no, I really, he's like, I don't want any. And he's like, would you mind if I did?
Yeah.
Would you mind?
I think that scene really, like Basil was talking about, like Lynch's, like what's takeaway from this movie. Like that scene basically says so much about how like David Lynch tries his movies to be like just this random thing that is completely weird, but it's also funny. And like, it's very rarely does he actually hit that same level of like uncomfortable humor. But I thought, yeah, I like that too. I think like visually, for example, the scene, it was really brief when he's in the dry cleaners, but I thought that looked fucking great. Like the dude who he speaks to looks great. The steam coming out everywhere. Steam, and like, it's just like, man, this is like an intense environment. And it's just like one or two shots that are actually like even in there, but it's like really like, oh man, he's like a really kind of adept dude in terms of also like production design.
Another like aesthetic thing that I did think was really funny joke is that like when they finally talk him into doing it, and he's signing the paper, like as he's signing the paper, there's like a smash cut to them like sticking a scalpel in his like face or whatever.
Yeah.
Like pen, paper, scalpel, skin, same thing.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. Yeah. Ruben disappeared for the listeners.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I think his internet died. Yeah, I think that's. Mm. We've lost him.
No one to argue with. Now we can all talk about how great this movie is.
Yeah.
But what was I gonna say? I was wrong before. It wasn't the old salesman guy. It was the Manchurian Candidate guy who tells him that he's absolved of all responsibility. It's like after he turns into Rock Hudson, when they're like talking to him. I'm sad that Ruben's gone though, because I did want to talk to him about the extra textual stuff, because that was something that Haley picked up.
Yeah,
right away.
Yeah,
that like the only meaningful connection he has is with this like guy who's like his really big buddy, and like that he like wants a different life, and then he gets a different life that's like a playboy life, and he's like, oh, I don't want this life either. This is still not the like gay life that I actually wanted.
Yeah.
And that like there's like a weird reading of that when he goes to visit his wife, and like he has this really flimsy excuse that like if you're reading the movie along these lines sounds super sexual, where he's like, yeah, I was like a really close friend of your husband. I'm a painter. I was just like, I knew your husband well. Tell me stuff about your husband. So
yeah,
I think that, you know, Ruben might be right that the movie doesn't support it, but that like I mean, Haley, who had no idea of, like, the history of the movie or of that reading in general, picked up on it super fast. And I was like, oh, yeah, you're right. I wasn't even picking up on that, but she grabbed it. So I was also going to say that there's something about that scene that reminded me a lot of RoboCop. And I was like, oh, I wonder if that's the scene where RoboCop goes back to his house after he's dead. It's like... Right. A reference to this scene?
That wouldn't surprise me.
That's a more wow. I didn't even think of RoboCop as another version of the same sort of story, but like yeah, it's also a guy who gets kind of railroaded into living a second life that's completely different and ends up not at all being what he wants to be.
So secretly, RoboCop is about Rock Hudson, and, you know.
Secretly, RoboCop, a remake of Seconds. Yeah. Very interesting.
Also, RoboCop has a much more romantic ending in that he is able to reclaim some of his lost life.
Yeah.
True.
Good old Arthur Hamilton sure can.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess you could also argue that the playboy life that, you know, is given to Rock Hudson's character is also, like, kind of eerily reminiscent, like a really weird, fake and dark version of the movies that he played in, too. Like, you could say that, like, Rock Hudson's entire career was made playing exactly those kinds of dudes that were about as, like, deep in their as in their character as, like, oh, he's a painter and he's rich and he's handsome.
Yeah.
Right? And, like, ladies fawn over him, and then that's it. And, like, there's a lot of this movie reads like an extratextual version of Rock Hudson's career, and not like career and person persona. Another thing is obviously, well, there's a thing about the way to read his relationship with his wife also as a, well, as a closeted man's relationship with his wife, in terms of, like, oh,
yeah,
you know, like he was.
That was definitely one of the things that Haley mentioned. Yeah. That, like, the way it focuses in on their kiss when she's, like, trying to kiss him and he's, like, not into it at all.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, that
there's sort of a...
The obvious first annotation is, like, oh, they're in a happy marriage. But the second one is very clearly linked to the scene that you described earlier when you were talking about, oh, him visiting and talking about being his friend that he was so close with and so on. It's, like... In a weird way, he's almost talking about, like, that the guy actually had that friend or whatever, or that was his wish to have that friend. So there's a lot going on in that sense. Right. And, like...
And, I mean, the phone call where, like, you know, they have this... The picture of them, like, together, and then it's, like, etching on the trophy is, like, Fraternus Eternus or something like that. It's like brothers forever.
Fidelis Eternus.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, but you died and whatever. Like, at first, when I was first watching the movie and the guy calls and he's like, no, you're dead. First, I was thinking, oh, like, just like the first, before I really, you know, the movie continued, I was like, oh, did he kill that dude? Maybe he killed that dude. Uh-huh. And then, like, oh, yeah, wait, this movie is about, like, there's, like, Rock Hudson in it as, like, I heard there was, like, some commentary about his, about his sexuality in it, but, like, not obvious, like, meta commentary. Like, huh, oh, is this about how he killed his, like, gay best friend so people would not find out about their relationship or whatever? And, like, then, like, a lot of it, what happens, like, so much guilt that's pent up that he wants to, like, make it right to this gay friend, and then in the end, it's like, oh, well, that person gets to do his life over, but then he has to die for, like,
I don't think that guy does either. I think that all those people waiting in there are just
probably.
I mean, just the way that the, like, Colonel Sanders guy talks about it is like, oh, we've have a lot of failures. 90% of these don't work out, but we gotta keep
he talks about profit sharing too. I was just like, oh, this is going into a weird capitalist place now. He's definitely not coming out of this one looking good.
Yeah, and I would put that as, like, a counter parallel to the loan officer thing or whatever, that I think that this movie is, like, one of those 60s movies that's coming down pretty hard on the idea of, like, the capitalist dream of the 50s.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I agree.
I can get behind that.
But, yeah, I definitely think that the idea that he went to Harvard and he's like, oh, this isn't good enough. And he's like, I'd rather have gone to some French school.
Yeah.
But then that's not even, like, really true. Like, he really wanted to be a tennis instructor, but they can't do that because
you're a tennis pro.
But you're 51 years old.
Yeah. Sorry, guy. What else did you really want? Oh, painting, I guess. Fine. Yep.
Yeah, and I like the line of it. It's just like him. He's like, I like to paint stuff.
Yeah. And then they...
The vague and amorphous then, dream.
I thought the scene was really funny with a guy who, like, preps him for his life, how his life is going to be like the guy with the mustache, who's like...
Yeah, that's the guy that, like, reminded me of the Manchurian.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, this is, like, another Manchurian.
Yeah, and he's like, yeah, so, you know, we came up with this whole, like, how your paintings are going to look. I think it's, like, this style, but don't ask me. I have no idea. Like,
yeah,
close enough.
That guy,
yeah. I'm not an art critic.
Yeah. But, like, yeah, that was really funny. I really liked that scene.
Yeah. But I also like the idea that, like, they're like, oh, well, you can just paint whatever you want, and it'll just seem like this radical transition. You know, this is your late period or whatever.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
And then when he tries to paint, all he paints is, like, a fake Picasso. Like, the only time we see him painting, he's just, like, doing a painting that's, like, a replication of a super famous Picasso painting.
Yeah, like, yeah. Oh, I know that it's Picasso. Like, it's like La Demoiselle's... Or La Mademoiselle's d'Avignon or something like that.
Mm.
Can't remember. Although, I can't remember the name.
I
of it
just
exactly.
just realized that in the Big Lebowski, what Jackie Treehorn draws is like a parody of that, but with a big boner.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's right. I forgot about that. He draws it on the paper. Yep. He tries to trace what he wrote. It's like a nice. Picture of the boner. Like,
But yeah, the body shape is exactly the same. I never put it together that was like
a man, Big Lebowski.
Yeah.
Finally decoded completely.
Yep. Full of pop culture references.
Nice.
Oh my god.
Sweet.
Nice.
But, yeah. I don't really have that much else to say. I think we got our points across.
Yeah. No, I think
I wish,
so, too.
Wish Ruben was here to weigh in at the end here, but yeah. Mm. Oh, well.
All right. This is your pick, so why don't you do the sign-off?
Yeah, that's my sign-off. All right. Well, thank you for listening. What's our next episode? We're doing this now where we give the next episode.
Oh, that's true. We've been forgetting to do this, but I'm pretty sure... Wait, let me double-check. Oh, man, so unprepared.
Yeah, I've forgotten what it was too. It's been a while since we've done it because we just did.
Oh yeah, it's gonna be Ilya's next pick, Crime Wave.
Oh nice.
Not the Sam Raimi one, not the other Canadian one from the '80s, but the 1954.
Yeah.
54. All right, Crime Wave from 1954. That's gonna be our next episode. All right. Well, thank you for listening to us hash this one out. If you like the podcast, please go on iTunes and rate and review us. Give us 5 stars if you like us. If you don't give us anything. Get out of here. But yeah, we or go to go to loosecannons.net and check out all of our other podcasts and some of our writings and videos. There may be some new stuff coming up on there soon, since we just did the end of the year stuff.
Basil's doing a weekly write-up of stuff on the website, so
right on.
Yeah, I've been starting to make some lists. I just started publishing them, but I'm gonna try to make a new list for every week for this year, so 52 by the end of it, hopefully. So.
Awesome. Yeah, so look forward to that.
Nice.
All right, so thanks for listening, everybody.
Yep. Thank you.
Bye.
Talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye. I'm gonna go to the bathroom.